like, I don't generally do these kinds of things. Like, I don't make New Year's resolutions. I make commitments to trying to do stuff in my life, but this feels, I'll say it, I don't really mean it this way. It feels a little gimmicky. Like, it's, oh, Thursdays. And it's like, it's not how my brain has usually worked, but I'm smiling because I want to try it. This kind of stuff clearly works for people. And I'm not saying it won't work for me. And I have no idea. And I think part of what you're asking me to do is suspend disbelief for a bit about why maybe this is not enough, or maybe this is not a big deal, or maybe I won't make it. And just try something that's connected to a goal I care about, and see where it lands me, is what I sense from you. Don't overthink it, but just try it and see what happens. And I'm smiling because that's not generally how I do things. I mean, I do plenty of things without thinking through them, but this is different and it feels like it's worth a try. So let me try.
Hi, this is Josh, and this is the Joshua Spodek Show, formerly Leadership in the Environment. I still bring you leaders in the area of the environment in the form of leaders and role models. Everyone treats stewardship like a burden or a chore, deprivation, sacrifice. So did I until I actually tried it seriously. It is a joy. Everything about it. We're here to share that joy. Meet amazing world-renowned people from all parts of life. Hear about them, what the environment means to them, and hear most of them find something meaningful to act on and then to share their experience. Why? Because stewardship and acting to help others for something greater than all of us creates about the greatest feeling humans can get, as does fresh air, clear water, delicious food, and clean land. That's what we're bringing you. If you've followed sensible expert advice on the pandemic, you've almost certainly read Ashish Jha. He's appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, CNN, Washington Post, everywhere. He's the professor of global health and the director of Harvard's Global Health Institute. Over 200,000 people have taken his online courses, which you can for free. Over 80,000 took Ebola, Preventing the Next Pandemic, and over 120,000 took Improving Global Health, focusing on quality and safety. As it turns out, Ashish and I were college teammates on the Ultimate Frisbee team. This was back in the 80s. I'll link to a few top articles by him. With so many interfaces between the pandemic and us, that is we, you and me, through health, through government, research, policy, and so on, there's a lot to read in these articles, and he comes at these things from many different directions, being an MD and public health, global public health. But I wanted to bring you in this episode the personal side. How do doctors and public health experts feel about things like people not following their advice, facing triage decisions, how to be heard? We talk about leadership, the intersection between the pandemic and the environment, and this overlaps with his directorship and his course. By the way, he created his Ebola course 5 years before this pandemic and predicted much of it. As did many, he wasn't the only one. But if predicting what's happened so far is not enough reason to follow his advice, I don't know what is. Let's wear those masks. Let's keep the distance going. Let's listen to Ashish. Welcome to the Leadership in the Environment podcast. This is Joshua Spodek. I'm here with Dr. Ashish Jha. Ashish, how are you doing?
Good, Josh. How are you?
I'm very good. And I mean, we're both smiling because we were trying to figure out the last time we saw each other, which was probably on a Frisbee field because we both played Ultimate in undergrad together. And then since then, I've seen your name a lot lately. You know, obviously, I want to bring people who know about pandemics and things on the podcast. You're right in the middle of it. So let's see. You're a professor of global health and the director of the Global Health Initiative at an institute at Harvard. Your name is all over the media. You picked quite a field to be one of the top people in the world in. How did you decide to go into it?
So I, as with all journeys, looks linear in retrospect, but was circuitous as I did it. You know, as I, after Columbia, I went off to medical school, did training. And as much as I loved practicing medicine, and I still do practice, and I enjoy that a lot, I decided I was really interested in policy and kind of public health. And so I started doing research and spent a lot of years really focusing on the U.S. healthcare system, issues around costs and quality. And then about six years ago almost, I took over Harvard's Global Health Institute. It was a new institute that had been created and was really asked to think about what universities can and should be doing in global health. And when I took on the job, it was right in the middle of the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. And I very quickly realized the university had a very important role to play when other institutions were failing. And so we set up this international commission, which I co-chaired, on kind of what went wrong in the global response to Ebola and how do we make sure it doesn't happen again. And that set off a whole series of work on how the world prepares for a pandemic. And so in 2015, I did a course, one of those, you know, massive open online courses, the MOOCs, a Harvard X course called Ebola Preventing the Next Pandemic, in which I try to use Ebola to think about if we hit got a pandemic in 5 years. So this was in 2015. The framework of the class was, if we have a pandemic in the next 5 years, how do we get ready for it? And obviously had no idea there'd be a pandemic in 5 years, and it turned out. And so we did a lot of work in thinking about those issues. And then this pandemic hit, and it's been crazy. But unfortunately, many of the things that we worried about in terms of the response have come true. And all predictable, every scenario had a situation like this as the most likely of what would happen in America and around the world. And it has.
Yeah, you said we had no idea a pandemic like this would happen, but it wasn't no idea. I mean, the number of times I've seen when, not if, from something from 2, 3, 4, 5, even 10, 20 years ago, it seems like people knew pandemics would happen.
Oh, no. If I said, I didn't know when a pandemic like this would happen.
Okay. You knew one would. Yeah.
Yeah. No, even in the 2015 course, the scenario that I laid out for experts was, I said, imagine we have a virus that originates in China and becomes global within a couple of months. Like, is the world ready for that kind of thing? That was the scenario that we all planned for. And so this idea that it was unpredictable. If I said that, I actually completely misspoke. No, this was what has been playing out here is exactly what we all worried about and thought about. We didn't know it was going to be a coronavirus. Actually, most of us assumed it was going to be an influenza virus. And none of us knew it was going to be in 2020, right? But specific timing was not known. But I've described this often as, imagine if there was a big earthquake in San Francisco. Well, no one will know the exact timing, but no one's going to be surprised. Like, that is a city prone to earthquakes. And so it's sort of the same kind of thing where the exact timing was not predictable, but this event was completely predictable.
So I have a couple of personal questions from your perspective, because you said you still practice medicine as a doctor. And so you have several roles here. You see patients, you have a policy. I mean, you must interact. You certainly interact with the media. You may interact with politicians.
A lot.
And I'm also really curious, what's it like seeing it play out, even though you know what could be done and you've advised on what could be done and they're doing some, but mostly not, or I don't know to what extent. I mean, they're not doing it all, and we could. How does it? I mean, I walk down the street in Greenwich Village where I live. I would guess it's like 20% compliance on wearing masks.
Yeah.
And on the weekends when the bars open and everyone's just in the street, I'm partly enraged. I'm disappointed. I have to say, I don't feel guilty, but maybe I do feel a little guilty about this. But I feel like some Schadenfreude. Like, I feel like I want them to get. Like, I don't really.
I get it.
But yeah, how is it like for you? I said, I mean, you're right in the middle of so many things.
Yeah, it's been a very humbling experience in lots of ways, Josh. I thought that if we could lay out for people what the right answers were, the what needs to be done, that people would do them, that people would do those things. And I have really struggled initially with the fact that, like, the federal government's response here has been just abysmal. It's hard for me to imagine that it could have been worse. And I talked to folks at the White House on the COVID task force. I talked to senators and members of the House on both the Republican and Democratic side. These are good folks. None of them want Americans to get sick and die. And then when I tell them what I think we ought to be doing, they all agree. Yeah, sometimes they disagree on a point here or there. We walk through it. We come to an agreement, or occasionally we don't. But largely, they agree. And yet, we have not been able to do what needs to be done to get this virus under control in our country. And it's really stunning. And it has really made me think harder about what is that gap between knowledge and action? Why is it so hard to get people to act when everybody agrees on what the actions ought to be? And then how do you muster up kind of the political forces to get the U.S. federal government to act when the president sees things in a way that's very different from how everybody else sees it? It's a really complex set of issues, and I've really been struggling with how to untangle it.
This is why I mean, what you're saying about people knowing what to do and not acting is that's the environment in general. I mean, I view the pandemic as a subset of our interaction with the environment. I mean,
it is. It is.
Yeah, it's. And I think there's plenty of science, and we should. I support doing more science, but I don't think giving people facts leads to people acting. And let the record show, Ashish was just like, nope, nodding his head like, no.
Right.
And that's why leadership has become my big passion. It's like, that's how do we go from, you know, it's one thing to lead people like in a sports game. You know, you want a great coach who rouses people to go. But there's also stuff that's based in our understanding of nature, science.
Yeah.
And it's not just like, let's hope we do well. It's lives are at stake. I mean, cultures are at stake. I'd love to talk to you more about leadership in the era of the environment in this, because I see like that seems to be a lot of what you're writing about, is we're lacking leadership. Or even no leadership might be better than what we have in some cases.
Yeah. In this pandemic, I mean, I would say we have seen good leadership from a lot of governors. A lot of governors have stepped up and have done really remarkable work. We've seen incredible leadership from mayors, and not all of them, not yours, but a lot of small city mayors, small town mayors have done incredible work. You know, I spoke early in the pandemic to the mayor of Hoboken because he basically closed down bars, restaurants before anybody else did. And so I think it was like on Meet the Press or something on a Sunday morning, I said, you know, Hoboken is the model for the country. Uh-huh. And that became a line, and then everybody was calling. And then I sort of quipped, I can't believe I'm saying that Hoboken is the model for the country. And so then, you know, the mayor called me and basically was like, did you have to throw some shade? I said, I apologize. But the point was, it was incredibly bold leadership from a mayor of a small, you know, small city. So we have seen great leadership. The problem has been that at the very highest levels of the US government, there's been a complete void. And it's been very hard for mayors and governors to make up for that void. They can't do it. That's not how our society is structured. And it's not how our government is structured. And that's been the challenge.
I'm also looking at leadership outside government. I mean, government is a place where a lot of people look. But for the environmental leadership, I've come to see governments and corporations are the last place. They will be dragged kicking and screaming into it. And leadership from other areas. I mean, I think of this as social cultural change for millions, tens of hundreds of millions of people to change your behavior. And I think of that usually comes not from government. I mean, my role models are Gandhi and Mandela and King. They worked with government eventually, but that was after decades of work.
Yeah. Yeah. None of them led the movements that they led as presidents and prime ministers. And Mandela only became president at the end of his career, but that was not his crowning achievement, right? His crowning achievement was ending apartheid. No, that's right. And so what's interesting...
I'm going to throw in academia as well, that academia is very poor leadership in the area of the environment, in my experience.
Yeah.
That they do lots of research and they tell a lot of people what to do.
Oh, yeah. I have stories to tell on that. Can I tell a story? Can I tell a story?
Yeah.
So when I came into running the Global Health Institute at Harvard, I won't give out names because it's not useful, but...
I like that. At Harvard. I won't give out names. Yeah.
No, I won't give out names of people. About to say. Uh-huh. No, it's just at Harvard because that's where I am. That's where I was. You know, so I came in, and when I was asked by my president of the university to run the Global Health Institute, I went back and forth because I wasn't sure I wanted to do this, and ultimately agreed because she made a very compelling case that global health had to be reinvented and that Harvard was a good place to reinvent global health. And her point was that we really have to think hard about what are the big pressing challenges facing the health of the world over the next decades and ask the question, is Harvard working on those issues in ways that really matter? That was her charge to me. And that was an interesting charge. And so then, as I said, I came in, the Ebola outbreak was happening. So we got all this work happening on pandemics. But the other thing is I looked across the landscape. I was not an environmental health guy. My approach to climate change was, you know, I would read the literature as much as I did, believed clearly in the science. But I was a passive observer, I'd say mostly, and thought, you know, we should do stuff on climate change and we should have a carbon tax or whatever policy. But I wasn't deeply involved in it. And then when the charge that I was faced with was think about the most important pressing issues facing the health of the world's population over the upcoming decades and answer the question, is Harvard doing enough to work on those issues? It was very clear to me that probably the single biggest threat to human health over the upcoming decades was climate change. Mm-hmm. Like that didn't feel like a subtle point. And that was very obvious. And so I said, cool. So I'm assuming at this great university with a lot of great scholars, there are probably hundreds of people working on the intersection between climate and health. Mm-hmm. And I went and talked to all the leading climate scientists who thought, yeah, health is important, but not sure that that's the first place I would go looking. And when I talked to the health people, they said, climate, like maybe in a couple of decades that might become important to health, but not really now. And I was looking at the data thinking, what? Like to me, I'm a health guy, so I see the world through that lens. I saw health as the most like important aspect of climate change. Mm-hmm. Like, and I was, as I was talk to people, I would say, you know, like you can't motivate people with 2 degrees Celsius higher temperatures in 50 years. You know, the way I look at it is, okay, it's like it was, you know, 75 degrees Fahrenheit yesterday. It would have been 78. Mm-hmm. That's fine. I'm underwhelmed, right? It's not about sea level rises and temperature changes. It's about the massive health effects. And again, there are lots of non-health issues with climate change. And I don't mean to turn all of climate change into a health problem, but I saw it as a health problem.
Can I also check, are you throwing in also other environmental things like plastic pollution and chemicals and PCBs and PFAS?
Yeah, this was one of the big debates. And so there was a colleague who really insisted that climate was too narrow a focus and that it was broader environmental change. And I have come to, of course, understand that it's not just about climate change. And there's a lot of other environmental changes that have big, profound effects on health, no doubt. But I wanted narrowly to at least, because climate change is not that narrow in terms of its health effects, to say at least let's get going on that. Mm-hmm. And let's go going on really thinking through and creating a framework and understanding how climate affects health and what we know, what we don't know. Let's generate an evidence base. Let's fill in the gaps and let's communicate about it. Because I thought, and I still think, and we've done a ton on this, that health is a much more compelling case for why we need to act on climate than sea level rises, at least in my mind. Mm-hmm. This is a topic I've come to really in the last 5 years. And it's been a very interesting journey because most people in academia have basically thought like they've been underwhelmed by this idea that we should be talking about the health effects of climate change. And I have seen health as, you know, I often say like health is the human face of climate change. It's how climate change becomes real for people. And so we've put a ton of time, effort, resources into building up this area of climate and health. And of course, as soon as we started talking about it, there were lots of people who immediately saw the connection, a small number of people who had already been working on these issues. And so now it's sort of growing as a field. And I'm not trying to say that I launched the field. There were other people who were working on that intersection. But it has been interesting to me to see how much resistance there was to this intersection, which to me felt as an outsider, meaning I wasn't an environmental guy, to me to be such an obvious thing to work on as a university.
Yeah, welcome to my world. I mean, I feel welcome to your world because people, it's just, they hear the stuff what to do. And then they say, that's very important, but I want to go see the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
And I think that they feel like, well, crap, if I really act on this stuff, then I'm not going to get to see the Eiffel Tower and I'm not going to get to see my mom who lives on the other coast. And so on a personal level, these little things undermine their everything.
Yeah. And I know we don't want to get too distracted by this, but I have never thought, I mean, again, I'm not an expert in this area of how to deal with climate change, but I have never thought that the primary response should be people shouldn't go see their mothers on the other side of the country, right?
Like that's where people just look for what excuse can I give that will enable me to keep doing what I've been doing. Once I get one, then they're done. The thinking stops and they're like, okay, great. Other people should change, but I'm going to do what I was doing before.
Yeah. I guess I've always seen these as like, ultimately we need broad policy responses. I'm not sure individual behavior matters, but I'm not sure a whole series of individuals seeing their parents one less time a year or other kind is going to make a big difference.
What I'm saying there is that people is the reaction that people have.
Yeah.
Well, first, I've actually come to conclude, I'm just actually saying this to you for the first time. Individual action
yeah.
is where everything starts. And I don't mean in the sense that, I do mean in the sense that that's where the votes will come from. That's, I mean, right now, at least as far as the environment's concerned, Trump is actually representing Americans very well.
Yeah.
If you look at their behavior and their emissions, Americans, they're, you know, through the roof.
Yeah.
And likewise, our pandemic behavior response. And I think it, yes, that will get the votes, but also everyone is, if you want to change a system, yeah. Oh man, I'm not good at saying this yet because I'm just kind of developing it, but it's, I'm realizing that we have to get people to change their behavior and to change their beliefs on a million, hundreds of millions of person scale.
Yeah. Can I push back though?
Please.
My sense has been, the example that I always sort of think of is when you, if you surveyed the Republican Party in 2014 and asked them how big a threat was Russia to the United States, most Republicans felt like it was a very big threat. It was one of the, you know, it was the kind of the leading threat to the United States. And you asked that question 4 years later in 2018, and Republicans mostly were like, no, Russia's a friend. Russia's an ally.
Gotta get elected.
And 4 years, Russian behavior didn't change in a dramatically positive pro-American way. One thing happened, which was that Mitt Romney was pretty anti-Russia and thought Russia was a source of badness in the world and badness for America. And Donald Trump thought Russia was great and was a source of goodness for the world and goodness for America. And so people's attitudes can change very dramatically based on the attitudes of the people they trust in leadership, as I see it. Mm-hmm. And so there is a battle to have billions of people think about their own carbon footprint and what they can do. But there's also just the sheer act of if you trust, there's a, somebody you trust who you think represents your voice, and they say, this is a really important problem, and we're going to go out and try to solve it, that will allow people, create a sense for people to. So leadership happens from both ends. Yes, from the grassroots, but it can from the leadership as well, right?
It can in principle, but it's not going to happen with anyone who's going to get elected in the next election. So we got 4 years to wait on that one.
You don't think Biden's going to take serious action on climate?
Relative to what he could, no.
Relative to Donald Trump, sure.
Relative to Trump, sure. But that says absolutely nothing. I mean, that really says nothing.
It's a low bar. Yeah.
Anyway, I want to get back to pandemic stuff.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that when I had my brother-in-law on about a month ago, he's a surgeon and he's on the front lines in New York City. One of the big things for him is as the numbers started increasing, he was starting to realize he might have to make triage decisions.
Yeah.
And this was like really... I hadn't heard someone talk about it personally. And I wonder if that's something that you faced. Have Americans had to make those decisions? What's it like when you see it coming up?
Yeah, so I haven't practiced during these because I do these inpatient ward months and I wasn't scheduled to be on service during these times. And so I haven't practiced during the COVID outbreak. This was something we talked a lot about as the numbers were starting to get bad about what would be the framework that we would use to decide if you have a 70-year-old and a 60-year-old and one ventilator, do you automatically just give it to the 60-year-old? And those are incredibly difficult decisions. We've never felt comfortable as a country, and I've never felt comfortable making such hard cutoffs by age or by other factors. So I think there was a lot of discussion around that. My sense is that thankfully we did not end up needing to do that very often. There weren't a lot of places people were turned away knowing they would die if they didn't get the services they needed. But we are very early in this pandemic. And so we may confront those issues yet again. And obviously, I'd love to figure out how not to confront those issues. But we should have a thoughtful approach to how to deal with those kinds of things.
I suspect that that's one of the things motivating doctors most that's got to be one of the last thing a doctor wants to do. Is split their time, split their resources.
Yeah, the primary model of clinical practice in America is your job is to think about the person in front of you and not worry about the broader societal impact. If there is a person in front of you who needs a ventilator because they have respiratory failure, their lungs are giving out, and they need a ventilator, if you can access a ventilator, you are going to give your patient a ventilator. You're not going to worry about, well, what about the guy who comes in after? What if he or she needs a ventilator more? It's not your job. Your job is to get the patient who's in front of you a ventilator. And that's really good. Because then when you're a patient, you're not wondering, is the doctor not offering me the therapy because she or he thinks that somebody else is more worthy? Because that actually leads us down a bunch of paths that we don't really want to be going down, where physicians are making decisions based on their own biases and preferences and predilections. That's not what we want. We want people to do the best they can for the person in front of them. But the fear was that I would be forced to make a decision saying, I can't give this to somebody who I can save their life, but I can't do it because I don't have it. And I'm going to give it to somebody else.
Yeah, to me, that is something that motivates me to wear a mask. I mean, certainly my own health is, I care about my health.
Yeah.
The health of people around me. My mom is older. She's in her 70s. I mean, there's a hospital up the block from me. And at 7 o'clock, they do all the cheering. And I see people cheering with their masks off. And I'm like, I think they'd prefer you put the mask on and didn't cheer if you had to pick one and not the other.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And they wear it around their necks and they're just hanging from their ear. I'm like, as long as you got it, it's shocking to me, mind-boggling to me.
You know, it's interesting. Behavior change has happened quickly in many areas. I often think about the fact that, like, we went almost overnight from smoking in bars to not smoking in bars.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the big ones. And seatbelts and drinking and driving.
And drinking and driving, but it took a while, right? But eventually we got there. But smoking, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe smoking wasn't as overnight. But certainly, like, so if I want to get us to 80%, 90% of people wearing masks anytime they're out of their house, which is, I think, what is going to be necessary, or what would be really helpful. I don't know about necessary. It's a combination of we need rules and laws, right? And people who say, well, it infringes on my freedom. I say, I don't have the freedom to walk into a retail store and light up a cigarette. I don't have that freedom. Mm-hmm. And so you should not be able to walk into a retail store and not wear a mask. It's in my mind, the exact same thing. And so there is that. But it's not just going to be laws alone. Like, we need to have all of our leaders. And so every time they look at their leader, the leader should be wearing a mask. Mm-hmm. And so when, you know, Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo, like, they should never be seen in public not wearing a mask. Just, we have to normalize that stuff. And I think that is going to be a really important part of this, is that we need to, and we're not going to get that from the president, but we need to see it from as many people as possible, that that's just the normal part of being an adult in America during a pandemic. You're wearing a mask.
If you like the show, I recommend Acting, as my guests do. It works best with someone supportive, your spouse, parents, kids, neighbors, or friends. Learn the 4-step process I do with my guests and describe in my TEDx talks and do it together. You'll find yourself acting on something you care about, something meaningful. Whether you start big or small, doesn't matter. If you care, if it's meaningful, you'll keep doing it. You'll reach big. Eventually, stewardship will feel normal. You'll wish you had started earlier. Second, I recommend donating to help this podcast at joshuaspodek.com/donate. I promote degrowth and stewardship, which no advertiser will touch, but brings joy, community, connection, and abundance to you when you act, and global change in the long run. Help us keep going. That's joshuaspodek.com/donate. All right, you know what? I'm going to transition into the thing I was talking about before, about this process that I go through with my guests on environmental things. Because I believe it might be useful for you. The environment is something that matters to you. I mean, you're just talking about it. When you think about the environment, especially if you act on it, what do you think about? What motivates you on the environment? It could be many things.
What motivates me is health. Like, I have, over the last 5 years, really come to understand and appreciate, in a way I never did. I mean, as a physician and as a public health person, you'd think it would have been really obvious. And of course, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, I would have said, sure, environment matters. But I have come to realize that fundamentally, almost everything that happens to me, the air I breathe, the water I drink, huge effects on my health from the environment in a way that I haven't appreciated before. And so what motivates me is not a love of the planet Earth, though I have love of the planet Earth. It's a nice mm-hmm. planet, best one around. It's that if we have more environmental damage, it makes it really hard for my kids, my family, but certainly my kids as we think about the future, but even mine, to have a healthy, productive life. That, like, it really has a very profound effect on our lives and our well-being. And that's what motivates me to think much more about the environment and care much more about the environment.
Are there specific instances or images or something that might happen or something that did happen that comes to mind specifically? I mean, is it broadly health or is there something in particular?
I mean, there are lots of specific examples from the trivial to the, but like in my own family, you know, for instance, it's like a minor thing of, but it's not that minor, like a bunch of us, but I personally have like really horrible seasonal allergies. And because of climate change, seasonal allergies are getting worse and they're lasting longer. We know this. Mm-hmm. And like, it has really driven home for me when I'm still super itchy and sneezy well into mid to late June, or it starts in February, that like, my God, like we really, this is a different world that I'm living in. What used to be an annoyance for 6 weeks is now really awful for 4 months. It's stuff like that, that for me, just connecting the dots to, and one of my kids has a similar thing. So just sort of like saying like, these are the manifestations where we have to connect the dots between what's happening in the environment and what I'm experiencing on a day-to-day basis. And again, not that seasonal allergies are, I mean, for some people, it's truly debilitating. For me, it isn't, thankfully. But it's stuff like that that I think becomes really important to connect.
The reason I ask is that a lot of people, that's your lived experience. And a lot of people will say, you know, Bangladesh is going to be half underwater. But that's actually farther removed from someone's personal experience, and that often will separate them from their experience of, yeah, of the environment.
Yeah.
And what actually motivates people is their own personal experience more than something that, however big, may seem abstract.
Yeah.
Well, the next step is to say, based on this experience, based on what motivates you, I invite you, and this is at your option, to think of something that you could do to act on that. Now, I'm not saying to fix all the world's problems, because people often jump to what's the biggest thing I could do, or what's the thing that the New York Times recommended me to do. But it's to think of something, and a lot of people tend to have something that they've been meaning to do, but it has to be something that you do yourself that you're not already doing, and it has to be something measurable, not just education or awareness. And most people, it takes them, like, we have to go back and forth a couple of times, but something often comes to mind.
Yeah.
And the measure is not how big it is.
Right. I do have to think about what that would be. I can certainly think about, I probably have a pretty substantial carbon footprint, right? So one thing I can think about is, how do I reduce my carbon footprint, and something very specific. I mean, there are lots of places and lots of ways you can measure your own. I haven't done that.
It doesn't have to be for a long time either. It can be short term, just as an experiment.
Yeah. All right. So do you want me to try to identify something now?
Yeah. Any one thing. Yeah. And then I'm going to ask you, if you go for it, then I'll say, how long do you want to do it for? And I'll say, can we talk again after you've done it?
Yeah. Yeah. Boy, I'm trying to think of, like, part of it is like with carbon footprint, I would have just said, I can imagine like reducing my travel, but no one's flying anywhere right now. So it's hard to know.
I know people flying right now. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Well, I guess some people are. I haven't flown in a while, and I have no intentions to get on an airplane anytime soon if I can avoid it. So what else can I do? And I'm trying to connect it to the example I used around seasonal allergies and climate change as a way to say, what could I do to, I feel like, do you have suggestions or ideas or things that I'm struggling here?
The big thing is you don't have to make it big. It's really, because what I find, this is what my whole third TEDx talk is about, is that big or small, people get really hamstrung if they feel like if it's not big enough, it's not worth doing, or if it's too small, then it's also not worth doing. But what I find is that when people act, then they find that the first one is often hard to come up with, but the next one, often they'll come up with it on their own. They'll start by doing something like, this whole thing started when I was talking to a friend, and I was telling him about how I pick up at least one piece of litter every day. Actually, just before this, I was walking around my neighborhood picking up litter. And he said, oh, I'm going to do that. And so he decided to pick up litter, 10 pieces of litter a day for 30 days.
Wow.
At the end of 30 days, I asked him how it went. He said, first, at the beginning, he felt weird picking litter up because people might see him. At the end, he felt weird passing it by without picking it up. That sort of change happens a lot. Also, he on his own just looked up like, oh, as long as I'm doing this, what more can I do? And so he halved his meat intake. And I never talked to him about food before.
Yeah.
And this type of thing, it doesn't always happen, but it often happens. And this is why I'm saying, like, why I think individual change is so important. If you think of individual change as how much is it, then you're looking at the wrong measure.
Yeah.
I'm not going to argue that a lot of little things don't add up, but to me, what matters is, big or small isn't important. If it's meaningful, if it's coming from your connection with your lived experience, then you'll do more. Big things add up.
So I like that. I like that. So actually, if it doesn't feel like it's too wimpy, I'm going to actually, the one that as you were talking, really struck me as something that feels meaningful that I feel like I could do and would want to do, is I could cut out, so I almost surely eat too much meat, and I could cut out meat for one day a week. You know, there's a meatless Monday kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I just have never, I've never done things like that. I've never sort of taken on the, I'm going to do X as a, but that feels meaningful because it is about reducing. I mean, we know meat has a much larger carbon footprint than, so if it doesn't sound wimpy, I'm going to, let me commit to trying to not eat meat on Thursdays.
Okay. Now, what I like to do next is I make sure it's a SMART goal, specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, time-bound.
Yeah.
And that sounds pretty, everything time-bound. When could we talk about it? When you could say, you could have like a good experience of it to share.
Like 3 months? Or is that too long?
It's up to you. I mean, I've had people do year-long things. I've had people do, sometimes when they say like, I want to give up meat completely, it like a week is huge.
Yeah, I could, I'm not doing that. I couldn't do it. I don't want to. But let me try 3 months. It's okay. 12 weeks. It's 12 Thursdays.
All right. So when we, after we stop recording, if it's okay with you, we'll, or maybe with your helpers, we'll set up the next conversation.
That sounds fine.
Now, this is audio only, so people can't see, but I see you smiling. Is this something that you are looking forward to doing?
It is. And it's unusual because, as I said, I don't generally do these kinds of things. Like I don't make New Year's resolutions. I make commitments to trying to do stuff in my life, but this feels, I'll say it, I don't really mean it this way. It feels a little gimmicky. Like if, oh, Thursdays. And it's like, it's not how my brain has usually worked, but I'm smiling because I want to try it. Like, you know, this kind of stuff clearly works for people. And I'm not saying it won't work for me. And I have no idea. And I think part of what you're asking me to do is suspend disbelief for a bit about why maybe this is not enough, or maybe this is not a big deal, or maybe I won't make it, and just try something that's connected to a goal I care about and see where it lands me is what I sense from you. This like, don't overthink it, but just try it and see what happens. And I'm smiling because that's not generally how I do things. I mean, I do plenty of things without thinking through them, but this is different and it feels like it's worth a try. So let me try.
All right. I can make it sound really awesome for you if you prefer and say this is experiential project-based learning in the style of John Dewey. And it's, you know, there's lots of pedagogical research in this area.
Yeah.
And now you can feel, now you can tell your friends why you're doing it. It's like, oh, this is a very important experiment.
I love it.
Also, this is, you were talking about leaders not doing things. And I'm going to give you two scenarios. Bill Gates puts a lot of funding into pandemic research and things like that.
Yep.
If he also puts a lot of effort into climate change. Now, if he says we should all lower our carbon emissions, and then he flies somewhere, a lot of people will say, well, what one person does doesn't matter. It's not that big of a deal. It's important that he puts the money and donations into things and he motivates people, but his personal thing doesn't really matter. Okay. Now imagine he said, we gotta wear masks. And we got to keep the pandemic and do what we can to stop the pandemic. And then he had a party with 300 people. No one wore masks and everyone was really close to each other, chanting and singing and breathing and stuff like that. No one would say, oh, it's just one person. Even if all 300 people got the disease, it's only 300 people out of billions and billions. No one would say that. Right. Somehow in the environment, this is why I think the thing about the Eiffel Tower comes into play is that people see, well, if he doesn't, then I can't. And if I can't, oh, I don't get to see the Eiffel Tower.
Right.
And they lose somehow that like for hundreds of thousands of years, human beings have not really traveled. I mean, with rare exception, they wouldn't really travel farther than like 100 miles from their home. And they weren't lacking adventure. We don't have emotions that they didn't have.
Right.
On the contrary, if I feel that my only way of getting adventure is I have to fly somewhere, I'm actually probably going to have less adventure in my life.
Yeah.
And so you were saying, it's not that I am saying, give it a shot, try it out. But really, I'm changing the focus from, in my heart, from management to leadership, from numbers and compliance to ideas and stories and emotions and inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't manage your way into, Martin Luther King was not a manager. No. I mean, he didn't actually, the Montgomery bus boycott was mostly management, but the I Have a Dream speech is leadership. And we have plenty of management, but management without leadership, you don't get cultural change on the scale of hundreds of millions to billions of people.
That all sounds exactly right. And this is why Right. It is about modeling behavior. So in that, in your example, you know, when you have people, celebrities talk about climate change and then they get on their private jets and fly to Davos to talk about climate change, there is a bit of a disconnect that people feel, right? That this sense of that you have to act. And so I think, I mean, there's no question in my mind that in leadership, in the roles that I have played and great leaders I have worked with, or it's so much about modeling behavior, and it's so much about inspiration through personal action as much as it is about laying out the ideas that inspire people.
Yeah, I talked about my role models earlier of Gandhi and Mandela and King. And increasingly, it's also people like Patton and Eisenhower who get people, they find ways to motivate people to do things, I mean, risk their lives. And that's the kind of, that's totally absent. There's nothing, and they weren't asking people to do things that they didn't do themselves.
Right.
Well, I guess, I mean, Eisenhower didn't storm the beach himself, but I don't think leadership by example is sufficient, because people can see someone else acting and say, well, that's good for you, but not for me. But if you don't live the values that you instruct others to do, you've lost it. Yeah. No one will, your legacy is nothing. People will, they'll actually follow your behavior, which is to tell other people what to do while not doing it themselves.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons why in this pandemic, it's been so incredibly hard to make any progress as a country. You know, it's interesting. There are lots of countries that are doing quite a good job. And fundamentally, one of the big differences between those countries, they don't have better therapies, better tests, better vaccines, and none of that stuff. They largely have better leadership.
Yeah.
And what differentiates the New Zealands and the South Koreas and the Germanys from us is much better leadership. It's really all there is.
Yeah. What got us to the moon was leadership. What got us the Oppenheimer was the father of the, well, the bomb is not such a very peaceful thing to think about, but he wasn't the best physicist. He was the best leader.
Yeah. And we will end up having, certainly over the next 6 to 9 months, by far the worst set of outcomes of any high-income country on a per capita basis, on a total basis, whatever metric you want to use. And it is simply a failure of leadership.
Yeah, to people who get it, it's right there. Most people associate leadership with, at best, management, but more often authoritarian, telling people what to do. And that's not what I'm talking about.
Yep.
What we have is actually people leading, but they're leading the opposite direction. I mean, I would say in the air of the environment, the Koch brothers and Donald Trump are actually the most effective leaders. If you ignore the direction, they're very, very effective.
Yeah.
And there's no one comparable. I mean, I'm working on it.
Yeah.
But that's, we don't have something in the opposite direction. We just have people saying what to do without themselves doing it. And the flip side of that is that the opportunity for leadership is tremendous. The opportunity, I mean, I usually talk to a lot of people I talk to tend to be in the business world and they're trying to get ahead in their careers. And I say, there are more CSOs than ever, but nothing, chief sustainability officers than ever, but nothing compared to what there could be.
Yeah.
And if you want a CSO position, don't wait for it to happen. They want someone who's experienced and you come in and make the proposal and start by acting.
Yeah.
And I see huge opportunities in the area of leadership in the pandemic. I haven't thought about it as much because it's not my world. Well, it is now.
It's everybody's.
Not as much as it is your world. And I just see tremendous opportunities for leadership for people who want to lead.
Yeah.
And I see you putting yourself out there and you're not just saying, you're not saying little things. Some of your articles are pretty big, especially some of the early ones. Like you're proposing bold initiatives and you could have been struck down. You're taking personal risk. Not a lot of people doing that. But big opportunities for that. Man, de Blasio is like, the pandemic's hitting and he's still driving to, I mean, now, it's, I don't think he is now, but he was still driving to the gym in his SUVs. And I don't know if you know about all that.
Yeah. Without turning it into too much of a, possibly like, he's been about as bad of a political leader as I have seen outside of the president of the United States in terms of just kind of just getting it all wrong, communicating it all badly. Like, it is stunning to me that the most important, I shouldn't say the most important, certainly the largest and most consequential city in America has been led so badly. But, you know, here we are. And, you know, there are these, like, as I said, I keep pointing to these incredible, like, unexpected sources of great leadership whether it's Amy Acton in Ohio, or I'm blanking on the name of the person in Santa Clara County who was the first one. One of the reasons San Francisco didn't get hit hard and the whole Bay Area did really well is because of a health commissioner, basically, in one of the counties there, who just like made it a big deal before everybody else did. And that whole area ended up shutting down early. They've done great. I mean, it's incredible stories of people who, when the evidence was clear, but all the political pressures were against them, they just stood up and said, here's the right thing to do, and got it done, and made a massive difference.
It's available to everyone, really.
Yeah, it's available to everyone. And it is, you know, the fear of getting things wrong is, or being out on your own, is something that I think is real. And I felt it. Like, I was relatively early in saying we need a national shelter in place a couple of weeks before it happened. And I laid out for people on, you know, on national television, like, if we wait two more weeks to do it, it's going to be many thousands more lives. And here's why. And for the first couple of days, I got an immense amount of pushback and hate mail and all that stuff. I wasn't, by the way, like somebody way ahead of everybody else. There was a bunch of us who were doing that. But I realized I was doing it based on what I thought was the right thing to do. And if I was wrong, I was going to be wrong. But I had to at least say what I thought was right. And it's been, there's been a series of those kinds of things throughout this entire pandemic.
So I want to wrap up with a few. I could really go on for a long, long time, and I would love to. And I hope on the next time we do. Also, by the way, we'll talk again in 3 months. If between now and then you feel like I've gotten a good experience, let's share it, because I suspect that you will find leadership techniques in your behavior that apply in these other things. And I'm happy to talk about those things, because this is, this is actually like project-based learning.
Yeah.
Oh, and also Peter, well, I shouldn't say his name because I'm a snapper. You remember our teammate.
I do.
He was on top of this way ahead of everyone. And he was like, Josh, this is what to do. And I didn't say like take a leadership role, but I followed his advice like way before. And then like months later, I'd hear from everybody else.
Yeah.
Also, do you know Dr. Michael Greger, the guy who does nutrition facts? He's he was a pandemic guy. He's gone into nutrition, but he did a couple things on where pandemics come from, are interfacing with wildlife and factory farming. And I see very little focus on stopping pandemics from starting.
Yep.
An overpopulation is these things.
Yeah. I don't know about overpopulation, but I have said multiple times that we are entering an age of pandemics, and it is the combination of globalization and human interactions with the environment and environmental change, whether it's deforestation, whether it's, there's a whole set of things. Mm-hmm. All of that is what's leading us to a point where we've already seen a big uptick in large disease outbreaks. And we should expect to see more and more in the upcoming decades, that we really are going to have many more pandemics. And so the question becomes, how are we preparing for the future pandemics?
Is there much focus on how do we stop the pandemics from happening?
I mean, yeah. No, there's not much focus. That's what we need to focus on.
Yeah, prevention.
Maybe we can talk about that the next time.
Yeah. Do you also not see much attention focused? Like the ratio of attention? I mean, we got to save lives. Yes.
So this is, the question is, when is the right time? So a bunch of us have been talking about, when is the right time to talk about how we prevent the next pandemic? We've got to start talking a little bit about it now, but like, we're so early in this pandemic. We have so many more months of sickness and death and just disruption to our society to go, that people feel like, serious people feel like this may be a little early. Maybe in the fall, as we're starting to turn the corner, fall to winter, my guess is this pandemic is over next June, July. That's when like life will begin to get back to normal. Not being back to, it'll never be total normal, but we have a good year to run. And so maybe by fall to winter is the time to start talking about, hey, let's not do this again. And how do we not do this again? Because I think by fall, winter, people will be pretty depressed with how bad life, how hard life is, and they'll be ready for that.
Let's pick up here next time. I'd like to close. Is there anything I didn't think to ask, to bring up, or anything you want to say directly to listeners?
No, I've been thinking a lot about this, because one of the things I often talked about with climate change was, and pandemics, was how they were very related to each other. It's broader than climate change. It's about environmental change more broadly. So I was thrilled when you asked me to come join you on this podcast, because I thought it was an opportunity to begin to have that set of discussions. also, of course, as I've said, the single biggest determinant of what will either be a pretty successful set of management of pandemics in many countries and disasters in other countries is leadership. So those two things make me excited that we got a chance to spend some time together and excited to come back and talk more.
Well, thank you. Dr. Ashish Jha, thank you very much.
Josh, thanks so much for having me on.
You can guess that I loved hearing Ashish describe the smile in acting on something, not just talking about it. As I explained, my goal isn't a trick, but it's to develop leadership skills through experience. I can't wait to hear his results, partly for the personal experience of what it's like for him going without meat once a week, but mainly because his passion for effective action on the pandemic and on global warming. With that, I suspect that he'll come up with techniques to lead others and ways to apply them that, with his position at Harvard and upcoming at Brown, he'll be able to act on these things and make a big difference. So I will see you back here after his Meatless Thursday's commitment. How many people are bringing a message of joy from what everyone calls saving the environment, but I call the future? Step by step, this podcast is creating a culture of joy, community, and connection around sharing and acting on our environmental values. Again, there's no profit in buying and wasting less, but we'll all love our lives and relationships more when we do. I can use your support. Please donate at joshuaspodek.com/donate. Again, that's joshuaspodek.com/donate.